Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
It's Tuesday, September 4th, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll talk with author Miriam Powell about her new biography of the Browns of California, Governors Jerry and Pat Brown, a political dynasty that helped shape California and the nation. We'll also talk to poet Brian Turner and find out about his new project that finds him tackling an entirely different art form in a tribute to his late wife. We begin, though, turning our attention to the midterm elections. Now that Labor Day has come and gone, the campaign season is in full swing. Candidates across the state are working hard to separate themselves from the crowd, and female candidates face a particular set of challenges. As part of KQED's series The Long Run, politics and government reporter Katie Orr takes a look at how some women candidates are trying to get their message out and what they're trying to say.
This can be hard.
In this political ad, Democrat Katie Hill scales the side of a mountain as wind whips her hair.
But here, where we're from, we're not afraid of hard work.
Hill's campaign released the ad in the primaries when she was trying to break away from several other Democratic challengers. It worked. Hill is now facing incumbent Republican Congressman Steve Knight in a highly competitive general election. Democratic media consultant Kelly Gibson says the ad is effective because it's authentic. Hill really is a rock climber. But it also portrayed her as strong and determined, qualities Gibson says women often need to convince voters they have.
There's stereotypical attributes about men, leadership, aggression, the ability to speak up. And I think showing a woman in some of those more typically male spaces allows voters to sort of assume some of those qualities without us having to prove those qualities.
But women face a delicate balance. While they want to show they're strong, voters also expect to see their compassionate side. Kayla Jones is 24 and running for mayor of Seaside, California, where she currently serves on the city council. She chooses to highlight her family in her campaigns. She says it humanizes her.
I like to show off my daughter and show off that I am a young mother, and my husband and I are a working family, and that we share the same experiences as Seaside voters.
Republican Morgan Murtaugh is also young, just 26. Murtaugh is running in a long-shot bid for Congress near San Diego, challenging Democratic incumbent Susan Davis. But she has the benefit of being a social media native.
Social media has been a part of my entire life. I mean, I grew up in this generation, so I've been doing a lot of social media since I started getting involved in politics.
Whatever the method, Democrat Katie Hill says it's important to acknowledge what's at stake for women.
This is a real political moment for us. This isn't just about my race or about even flipping Congress, but this is a chance for us to equalize the number of women who are representing us in Congress.
Candidates hope that message will drive voters to the polls, no matter how they hear it.
That was Katie Orr reporting for KQED's series The Long Run. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. The number of Californians without a place to live has been going up, and many of those people hold down a job. Working, while homeless, can offer the promise of something better, but it also brings a new set of workplace challenges and worries. As part of our statewide California Dream Collaboration, KPCC's David Wagner reports.
And I am calling to confirm your appointment with us for tomorrow.
Narita is wrapping up a shift at her job in an LA optometry shop.
I do the pre-testing, so I take measurements of their eyes. After that, the doctor sees them.
At the end of each shift, 6 days a week, she turns off the display lights in the eyeglass cases. She sets the alarm, locks the door, and walks out to her car. And some weeks, she hasn't had a place to go home to.
There's been several times where I just slept in my car, and I parked close to the gym because that's where I get ready in the mornings.
Narita came to LA with her two young daughters almost a year ago. We're only using her first name to protect her identity. She's rented rooms for a few months here and there, and she's staying with a friend for now. Someone has always been willing to let her kids spend the night. She never thought finding a place of her own would be this hard.
You have to really focus on work when you're at work and try to put on a face that everything's okay. You know, once you're done, it's you break down because that's, you know, you don't have a place to go.
It's not easy getting numbers on the working homeless in California, but the estimates we have suggest it's not uncommon. Narita hasn't told her boss she doesn't have a stable place to live. She says she'd be embarrassed, and she wonders if she'd be treated differently.
I don't want him to have a different view of me, and to think that I'm homeless is going to affect my work life.
Workers have protections on the job when it comes to things like their race and gender, but
there are no laws in California that protect you from being discriminated against based on your housing status.
Jessica Bartholow with the Western Center on Law and Poverty was one of the people pushing for a 2012 California bill that would have changed that. Groups like the California Chamber of Commerce opposed it, and the bill died in committee. Bartholow looks at today's crisis and wonders why California hasn't reconsidered it.
If we know that income is one of the best ways out of poverty, why wouldn't it be a best policy practice to make sure that people who are homeless and who are working are not at risk of losing their jobs or having reduced hours?
Some employers do try to help. Kim Wired is CEO of the Northeast Valley Health Corporation.
We don't have the solution with being able to solve everything with money. We're not a food bank and we're not a housing organization, but we can certainly help make those connections.
Wired's organization provides health services to people who are low income or homeless. She says in those few cases when an employee has fallen into homelessness, the connections to LA's homeless support system have been a huge help. Wired's advice to other employers is to know who to call.
It may take a little bit of digging to put a homeless resource list together for your staff, but those resources are there.
Of course, workers would have to feel comfortable telling their boss about their situation. Narita, the optometry shop worker, says her employer treats her well and pays her fairly. But she says when she has looked for housing assistance, she thinks people's image of homelessness has worked against her. Narita describes herself as a soccer mom, and she looks the part.
I've gotten comments like, well, I'm sorry, but if I looked at you, I wouldn't assume that you're homeless. Do I have to look like ripped clothes, dirty clothes? Like, I don't know what they expect me to look like. I have a job, so I can't come to work unpresentable or unprofessional.
Narita is not sure how long her current housing situation at a friend's place will last. Her biggest fear is that she'll end up back in her car, but this time with her kids in the back seat. In Los Angeles, I'm David Wagner.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. California's Supreme Court Chief Justice and immigrant rights groups criticized ICE after the federal agency arrested an undocumented man inside a Sacramento courtroom last month. It was just the latest arrest among many that have happened at courthouses across the valley. Here to tell us more about some of the backstory behind the recent wave of arrests is Valley Public Radio's own Monica Velez. Monica, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So this isn't the first time that ICE has made an arrest inside a courthouse in California, but it was significant because it happened inside a courtroom. Tell us a little more about what exactly happened recently in Sacramento.
Yeah, so in Sacramento last month, the Fresno Bee reported that ICE made an arrest inside the courtroom at the Sacramento Superior Courthouse. And according to the Bee, that was the first time it happened in the state. And the attorney for the man who was detained, he asked the judge to step in, but the Superior Court Judge Lawrence Brown, he didn't stop ICE from arresting him. In a statement to the Bee, the judge said that judges don't prevent lawful arrest warrants from being enforced.
Yeah, that's a very interesting story. And California's Supreme Court Chief Justice Tani Kantel-Sakue is speaking out against the arrest as well. She told Capitol Public Radio last week she thinks it's counterproductive, quote, to safety and people's respect and loyalty to the law. So she continues to be against that practice of arrests inside the courtroom. But this is not a new issue, Monica. As I understand it, arrests at Valley courthouses go back quite some time, dating back into the Obama administration.
Yeah, so in October of 2013, the ACLU, they wrote a letter to ICE officials, you know, detailing different instances and where people were arrested in Kern County. they, you know, listed out four different people's stories, and they all happened between 2012 and 2013. And some of these people were arrested, you know, like throughout the hallways of the courthouse, and they were there for stuff like, you know, paying their traffic tickets. One man was actually there to get married, and he got detained actually while he was already in an asylum case. He was in the process of, you know, filing for asylum. And he got arrested. He ended up, you know, getting released. But, you know, just the fact that this was happening at the courthouses was a very big concern to attorneys. The ACLU said that it stopped people from going to courthouses, you know, for basic services like paying traffic tickets.
So that was in Kern County under the Obama administration. And now fast forward to 2018, and we started to see this happening again in the Valley, but in Fresno County and other Valley counties. So what are people saying about these arrests? We heard from the Supreme Court Chief Justice. What are other people saying? Is this a concern for the court system?
Yeah, so immigration attorneys in Fresno and in Bakersfield have said that the presence of ICE agents at places like the courthouse, you know, adds to this culture of fear. And this has been something that's been, you know, kind of building up since it looks like since 2012 and 2013 when this started happening in the Valley. And obviously it keeps happening now, and there's been a lot of concerns and attorneys for when it comes, you know, for people who need to come to courthouses for different types of visas. One example is a U visa, where sometimes immigrants, undocumented immigrants, have to come to the courthouses, you know, to testify. And that's in order for them to have some type of legal residency and protection. But ICE having a presence at the courthouse, attorneys have said it's very counterproductive to the whole process of immigrants not having to have fear of law enforcement, but when they're at the courthouses, it's, I guess, really counterproductive to that.
And we should add that last week, an ICE spokesman told Capital Public Radio that California's sanctuary state laws are forcing them to make more arrests in public places like courthouses, now that they can't cooperate as fully with local law enforcement agencies and work within California jails. We've been talking with Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez about the ongoing arrests taking place at California courthouses, which last month escalated to arrests made by ICE inside a Sacramento courtroom. Monica Velez covers immigration and other issues for Valley Public Radio. Monica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back with more in just a moment, including our talk with author Miriam Powell on her new biography about Governor Jerry Brown and his father, Governor Pat Brown. Some interesting insights into that California political dynasty coming up next on Valley Edition.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Biographer Miriam Powell is taking on two subjects with her latest work. The acclaimed author of The Crusades of Cesar Chavez has turned her attention to perhaps the most influential political family in California history, the Browns. Edmund G. Brown Sr., better known as Pat Brown, who served as California governor from 1959 through 67, and Edmund G. Brown Jr., better known as Jerry Brown, who became California's youngest governor in 1975 and is about to close his record fourth and final term as its oldest governor. The book is called The Browns of California, the family dynasty that transformed a state and helped shape a nation. Miriam joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So the story of the Browns really begins far before Pat became governor. It goes all the way back 100 years earlier to the Gold Rush. Tell me about August Shuckman and the genesis of the Brown family in California.
Well, it's the genesis of the family and the genesis of my book as well, because I sort of first got interested in this in listening to Jerry Brown talk about his great-grandfather, August Shuckman, who was a Prussian immigrant who crossed the plains in 1852 and settled in Northern California in Colusa County, ultimately on the land, the ranch where Jerry Brown is building his retirement home. So I was kind of intrigued by that cycle, and that's sort of what got me interested in looking at the four generations of the family and the idea that they sort of span, you know, almost exactly the history of California as a state. August Shuckman was a very enterprising young immigrant who did a lot of land, drove a stagecoach and did things. He was not interested in prospecting for gold. He was interested in sort of making money off the people who came to prospect for gold, and ultimately ended up being an innkeeper and running a very well-known inn called the Mountain House that was at a strategic location in a fork in the roads in Colusa County.
What eventually set the family's political fortunes rolling down the slope of history, so to speak?
So August's youngest child, his daughter Ida, fled the sort of barren life in Colusa for the big city at the end of the century and met Edmund Joseph Brown, who was the son of Irish immigrants who had left Tipperary during the potato famine, and she married Edmund Joseph Brown, and their oldest son was Pat Brown, who was born in 1905 in San Francisco. So he and Pat Brown, from his sort of youngest years, very much wanted to, as he said at one point, he wanted to be the president of every club, whether or not he was a member. He was a joiner and a sort of runner for office from a very young age, and just was kind of a natural political leader, even in high school.
A lot of our younger listeners probably don't know much about Pat Brown or his role in California beyond the sort of one-line biography of being the governor responsible for the growth of transportation and water infrastructure in the state and presiding over the growth of the UC and CSU systems. Beyond that, who was Pat Brown, the politician and the leader?
Pat Brown was kind of the epitome of an old-style politician. When you talk to people who knew him, people just loved Pat Brown. He was the kind of person who went up to everyone, and there's a story about he would come out of his office in the governor's office in Sacramento and go up to school children and say, "Do you know who I am? I'm the governor of California." And he just took this tremendous delight in being around people, and was, you know, perhaps the greatest California chauvinist, or certainly a rival for that title. Loved California, really had that sense of California exceptionalism. And during his tenure, as you say, I mean, it coincided with this tremendous growth in population of California in the boom years. And he played a very significant role in shaping these institutions that continue to have shaped California for so long, in particular, as you said, the university and the State Water Project, and obviously both of which having a big impact on your listeners in the Valley as well, the Water Project for sure, and the university system, which ultimately, opened the University of Merced long after Pat Brown's time. But I write in the book actually quite a bit about the University of Merced in the sense of that being part of the trajectory of the university as an important force in California. So I tried to identify sort of themes that also tie into the family in ways in which the family illustrates things that are important and unique to California, and the university system very much being one of them. And obviously the fights over water and the future of water and the role of water being another. So, you know, Pat Brown was a politician of his time, very much pre-television, you know, loses in 1966 to Ronald Reagan, which was sort of unfathomable to him that an actor could become, you know, the governor of California. So he was a creature of that era, incredibly committed to the state of California and believing in the role of government as a positive force in people's lives.
Did Pat push Jerry into a life of politics? You know, Jack Kennedy campaigned for Pat Brown. We all know about the Kennedy dynasty and how they were set forth on that path in their family. Did Pat see that as a path for Jerry going forward?
So Jerry was the only, Pat Brown and Bernice Brown had four children. Jerry was the only son. Pat certainly, I think, reveled in the fact that his son ultimately became a lawyer and a politician. But as you probably know, and some of your listeners may know, Jerry, the young Jerry Brown, was very much turned away from that life and, in fact, entered a Jesuit seminary after high school and spent 3.5 years as a seminarian. So there, he very much rejected that life path, and yet ultimately, of course, embraced it. He's a very interesting mix of his mother and his father, someone who certainly in his later years also has come to very much embrace his father's legacy in ways that he perhaps did not do quite as much when he was younger. But, you know, he gets elected. Jerry Brown's first election was in 1969. He was elected to the Los Angeles Community College Board, which had just formed, and he ran. I don't remember how many, 130 candidates or something like that. And, of course, his name was Edmund G. Brown, Jr. His father was Edmund G. Brown, Sr. He had just been out of office only for a few years at that point. So he, you know, was overwhelmingly elected on the basis of his name. And similarly, in 1970, when he ran for Secretary of State, making the leap from, you know, Community College Board to Secretary of State, also his name obviously being a very big advantage. And so he used that for what it was worth, and his father did a lot of work for him in the campaign in 1970 and in 1974, his first election for governor, and did a lot of fundraising, which was really important at that time because Pat Brown had a network of supporters and was so beloved by a lot of people that he was able to, you know, really play an important role in his son's first campaigns for state office.
Jerry Brown was born in 1938, so that makes him a little too old to be a baby boomer. But he became governor at a time when boomers were coming of age and transforming California and the nation with the rise of counterculture, multiculturalism. Was he ever really in step with that generation, or was there always a distance there? And in what way did he embrace that and maybe also distance himself from it?
That's a great question. So he got his sort of start in politics as part of the anti-war movement in 1968. He became involved in the campaign to first draft an anti-war candidate and then to support Eugene McCarthy when he ran for president in 68. He was a McCarthy delegate and involved in the McCarthy campaign in Southern California. In fact, had a big split with his father at that point over, you know, who should be the presidential candidate. So he sort of enters politics in a way as part of that generation and with very strong feelings about the Vietnam War, but was certainly not part of the San Francisco Summer of Love scene or even the student protest movement particularly. He was much more an observer of that than a participant. But then his rise in terms of running for governor coincides with the Watergate years and the Watergate hearings. And one of his sort of major ongoing legacies, which is very much in the news these days, the Fair Political Practices Commission, grows out of an initiative that he drafts as Secretary of State and supports, which is the Political Reform Act. So, and as Secretary of State, he campaigns a lot and makes a major sort of issue about campaign finance reform, transparency in reporting, increased scrutiny of election finance reports, and so on. And that's very much in keeping with the post-Watergate era. And he, you know, in his 30s when he gets elected governor, so he's sort of part of that movement in the sense of the post-Watergate Nixon years.
What did Pat Brown, the elder, think of his son once he was in the governor's chair? I understand you had access to some letters exchanged between the two. Tell me more about that relationship once Jerry was in office.
Yeah, so Pat Brown's papers, which are at the Bancroft Library in Berkeley, are really a wonderful, wonderful resource because he was a prolific letter dictator and saved copies of all his letters and saved his incoming correspondence. So there's just reams and reams of correspondence with everyone, not only sort of letters to and from Cherry, but in particular Pat writing to other people about his son and other people writing to him about his son and people saying that he's arrogant and he's, you know, snubbing them, and Pat sort of being much more part of the political establishment at that time. So there's a certain tension, and he's trying to sort of ease that. And then in his first term as governor, Jerry Brown comes in very much to shake up the status quo, rejecting a lot of the sort of old boy political network, very white male political establishment. And therefore, his father writes many, many letters recommending people for different positions, including in particular judgeships too. And the vast majority of those recommendations were ignored, or as he wrote in one letter, I know that my suggestions just get thrown into the wastebasket, you know, but you really, really, really should appoint so-and-so as a judge. So Pat was the sort of personality who was, you know, not discouraged by that kind of rejection and just kept at it. And, you know, he just adored his son and reveled in his success, and was, I'm sure, frustrated at times by his advice not being taken or embraced more. But, you know, I think he was pretty, had a lot of equanimity about it. And they have, you know, since in some ways very similar visions and philosophies about government, and in some ways very different.
Jerry Brown is sort of notorious for being derisive of the notion of legacy. What sort of access did you get to the current governor for this project? And is he more open to talking about his father than perhaps his own legacy?
I had good access. I had several long conversations with him and talked to pretty much every other member of the family. There are a lot of cousins around and so forth, and his sister and two sisters who are around. So legacy, in his view, is something that happens after you stop to do anything. You don't have a legacy while you are still actively working and involved and engaged. And his view is that he will be actively engaged and working until he dies, and therefore he doesn't have a legacy until then. So I think it's not exactly a semantic issue, but it's partly that the idea, not that he will not have a legacy ultimately, but that he rejects the idea that he's sort of, that he's shuffling off into the history books right now. So I think that's part of the explanation of why he bristles at the use of the term legacy. That doesn't mean that he's not thinking about how the things that he's doing now will be regarded or, you know, what impact they will have in the long run. For example, he founded two charter schools in Oakland when he was mayor of Oakland and is still very involved with those schools. And I think that, you know, he said that those are an important part of his legacy because they will go on, you know, long after he's certainly no longer governor and potentially long after he's gone altogether. So I think he has a complicated relationship with the idea of legacy, but he also is very into talking about his father's legacy and honoring it and respecting it. And I think seeing his own work as part of that and as a piece. And he also, you know, as I said, that I got interested in this and listening to him talk in speeches about the Shuckmans and his ancestors. And he's been very interested in recent years in tracing that family history and in locating all of his cousins and bringing them together and sort of functioning as the family patriarch and convener in a lot of ways. Partly that's probably a function of age and partly just doing something new.
There's a long history of second acts in American politics. Richard Nixon, I could go on. How significant of a role did failure, and specifically Brown's failed presidential bids, how significant was that in shaping the man that we know today? And how unique was that experience?
I think, you know, Jerry Brown is very sui generis. I don't think you could find another politician remotely like him. And certainly probably could make an argument that he also is very Californian. It would be hard to have the kind of career and trajectory and rebirth that he had, political rebirth that he has had, he has a sort of insatiable curiosity and intellectual curiosity about the world around him. And so I think did a lot of things during what his friends refer to as the wilderness years when he was out of office between 1983, after he lost a race. He not only lost the presidential races, but he lost in 1982 a race for Senate to Pete Wilson. So he was out of office for a while. He traveled. He studied Buddhism in Japan, did various things, but was, I think, always looking for what the route back in was going to be, because he was very much of that political world by then and did different things. You know, was a move to Oakland, was a radio show host for a while, but then sort of figured out, again, what is one of the things that sort of makes him so unusual, figures out a way back into the political world, to climb into the political world in California through being mayor of Oakland, the first white mayor in, you know, decades of Oakland, an unusual and, in retrospect, very strategically smart choice. So that's just a path that, you know, very few other people, I think, would have even seen, much less chosen.
Before we go, there's sort of a mythology that's been built up about Jerry Brown, whether it's Governor Moonbeam or the notorious frugality as exercised in his first term. What was it? Sleeping on the floor or the couch and the
it was on a bed. It was just a bed. It was a regular bed. It was a box spring bed, but it didn't have legs. I can tell you that it was not that bad. But there was like basically no furniture in the apartment.
And so the Plymouth car, the
old Plymouth.
Yeah. Yeah, getting rid of the Reagan, the new governor's mansion. With all of that in mind and all of what we know of the governor from these most recent two terms, what don't we know? What is sort of the mythology? What do we have wrong about Jerry Brown, this creature that has occupied our political consciousness collectively for decades?
I think people don't recognize and appreciate how important his Jesuit background is in shaping him. I found that to be really interesting, really significant. He went to a Jesuit high school. He went to spend 3.5 years in the Jesuit seminary. There's a very strong both intellectual impact and just sort of life-shaping cultural tradition, I think, that has shaped him. And I think that the frugality thing, you know, it's not an act. It's real. It's who he is. I mean, did it help in terms of political appeal at that time? Absolutely. But he wasn't doing it for that reason. I think that he has a great sense of humor. I find him to be very, very funny. I don't think people see that. I don't think people see the kind of more human side of him all that much, more now than before. But the other thing that I think people do not really quite see, and that's not a part of the myth, but it's a little bit counter to the mythology, is how attached to tradition he is. So I think he's seen as being very iconoclastic, and partly that's because of the things that you described in his first terms. But he also is very attached to tradition, and he grew up in this world of his father's tradition, much of which he absorbed almost by osmosis. And so it's a funny mixture of pushing on in certain ways and making some very untraditional appointments, certainly his first time around, in a real effort to shake things up, but then in some ways being very attached to the importance of tradition as well, and to family, and to sort of things that I think people don't necessarily associate with him. So that his retiring to the ranch in Colusa, you know, that gets described in stories that have been written about him as, you know, kind of look at this wacky, crazy thing that Jerry Brown is doing now, going to live in a rattlesnake-infested, hot place that's got nothing there. Like, you know, isn't that really crazy? But for people who know him best, his oldest friends,
It's not crazy at all. It makes a lot of sense. The place is important to him. It's an ancestral home. He's interested in learning everything about the place in that way that, I mean, he has a very sort of, when he focuses on something, he wants to know everything about it. So he wants to know who the Indians were and what grasses grew there and what crops grew there and what changed in terms of the cycles of the weather in the land and so on.
It sounds like a fascinating story of an equally fascinating family. The book is called The Browns of California, the family dynasty that transformed a state and helped shape a nation. Biographer Miriam Powell was so kind as to join us today on Valley Edition. Miriam, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to talk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Fans of poetry and the Central Valley's literary scene certainly know the name Brian Turner. The acclaimed poet taught here in Fresno. He's now entering the world of music with a new project with his group, the Interplanetary Acoustic Team. He gained national honors for his poetry in his award-winning collection of poems here, Bullet, inspired by his time in the Iraq War. Now this new music collection brings together his musical ambitions and poetry from his late wife, poet Elise Kuznet. He joins us now on the phone. Brian, welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show, Joe. I appreciate it.
Talking about this new project, people know you as a poet. How does a poet make the transition into music, or has this always been something you've been active in?
Well, you know, I was born in Visalia, and I was raised in Fresno and Madera counties, and I was a Madera Coyote, you know, back in the day, and I learned the trumpet, and I used to play military funerals there in the valley when I was a boy, and then that shifted to bass guitar, and I used to play on Blackstone Avenue, I think it was Zapp's Park, and we used to play at the place called the Cadillac Club. And I was in a couple of rock bands and blues bands with some folks there. Sadly, my best friend who passed away, Brian Foyt, who's an amazing guitarist there in town, and Bill Toole is still there, and he's done some stuff for this project. In fact, it's connected to with art that not on the music. He's a guitarist, but he did some art for the album. You know, it started with music and writing at the same sort of at the same time, but the group activity was music, and the solo activity was writing. And then writing over the course of my life has been the through line, with music sort of appearing in waves throughout my life.
So the idea to bring these two together, it may not entirely be new, but this project certainly is, and also incorporating the work of your late wife, Elise Kuznet. Tell me about how this project itself developed.
I had no idea that anything like this would come out of that. It was pretty bleak, and I'm still... I can't imagine not grieving, actually. But the problem is, one of the things I want to do, once I started thinking about one of her poems that the title comes from, which is 1111, Me Smiling, that comes from one of her poems where it was about robots and cybernetics and kind of this futurism and stuff. And in the poem she says, in case I forget to tell you, 1001 is binary for a sigh. 1111 is me smiling. As I was thinking about that poem, this idea for the album came to me, and I realized I would use that construct of 11 as the template. So there are 11 songs on the album. In fact, the last song is 11 minutes, 11 seconds, 11 milliseconds long. So we really try to stay true to some of the binary code that her poetry evokes. So the music is in response to her language, and all the words on the album are hers, except for one British scientist in the very first song. But whether it's spoken by me or her words from recordings culled over the last couple of decades, she's narrating a journey through the album. And then myself and a lot of other musicians came together to try to create a kind of an acoustic landscape, or this landscape of sound that would be in concert with what she was saying.
Let's go ahead and listen to some of that, the initial piece from this new album, 1111, Me Smiling. This is the piece titled 1111. We'll be right back. Brian Turner is with us today. We're listening to music from his new record. The Interplanetary Acoustic Team is the ensemble, and the piece is called 1111. Poets often put words or try to describe things that are indescribable. Music certainly is one of those things, but how would you describe this style, this sound that you're going after here?
Oddly, on Amazon, it was listed as alternative rock, which I didn't, that's not what we put it in when we went through the music distribution system and all. But we shot up to number 69 in the world for part of a day. That was amazing, an alternative rock. But I guess there's little bits of funk, many different musical genres, but the main one is sort of an electroacoustic groove because there's a lot of modular synthesizers involved. So those who might have some memory of krautrock, for example, or K-rock, they might find some affinity there. You know, from my background, I think Pink Floyd is probably more prevalent in some of the music, but it's hard to tell with so much modular synthesizer work that's going on. You know, that's all kind of surface stuff, and I think to really get to the heart of your question, answer it, I would say that this project is a way for me not to create a kind of tombstone or memorial to her, but a way to continue to artist to create art together. So I'm still trying to fall in love with her. And the album is an excuse for me, or an attempt by me, to find a way for others to fall in love with her too.
How does the studio process compare to the process that goes into writing one of your poems?
You know, it's almost like watching someone sketch a drawing, and then they take their pencil, they flip it upside down, start erasing parts, and then they sketch, and they start with volumes and circles, and then suddenly you have a human being appear at some point, you know? And I discovered that quite a bit with these songs. We would start out with what I thought was a song or a version of a song, but then we would erase and subtract, and then we would add again until a few months later there was the song that we now hear on the album. So that's a little bit comparative to a poem, because a poem might start, I might write 3 or 4 pages worth of a poem, and then I really only get 2 lines out of it that become the start of what will one day be a poem that I would share with others.
Sometimes when I wake, I'm shaping the world with my hands. Sometimes when I sleep, the world shapes me. Once I was energy, hiding inside the light. With a shadow of light. Love rooted us together exponential.
What do you think your late wife would say about the project if she were able to hear it?
I hope she would love it. It's not her musical genre necessarily, but I think the intent and the approach, I think it would surprise her, and I think she would love it, even if it wasn't something she would normally flip to on the dial. You know, and I sure hope so.
I understand there's also some other elements to this. You have a limited edition vinyl pressing coming out with some local artists on the visual side getting involved. Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Bill Toole, I mentioned earlier, not only is he an amazing guitar player, but he's a wonderful artist. And so I asked him to do this kind of a limited edition art as well. So he's signed and numbered them, and so I don't want to give too much away, but the vinyl's it's a beautiful album with this blue marble, kind of semi-transparent. It's a 2-LP set, and there'll be some of Bill's art in there signed, so you could take it out, and the idea is that one might frame it, for example. And then there's another thing in there that I'm not going to tell anybody about too. So there's more than the music, you know. There's a whole collection of related ideas, and a lot of art, basically, sort of packed into one package. So they're stuck in customs right now at the moment. I didn't realize the process before. You know, I worked with Duophonic out of Germany, and they're making a beautiful album, but right now I have to get a broker and find a way to. Well, not find a way, but I have to work with them to get them released from customs so that I can actually have the album to ship out. So that'll happen in the next week.
Things that poets don't usually have to deal with, I guess.
No, I had to start a music publishing company, too. So now I'm a publisher of music. And that was a way I could hire some musicians. On this particular project, I didn't have to hire anybody. It was all friends doing it for the love of it. But it's exactly like, as a poet, I had no idea how complicated the music industry business is.
You mentioned earlier how Amazon put your music in this category that you really didn't desire it to be labeled as. Not that there was something necessarily bad, but it just was a label that was placed. It seems like music does that often. Do you think poetry does that as well? I often hear you referred to as a war poet or a military poet, given your experience in the armed forces and then your collections of poetry inspired by your service. Is that a problem for you?
I don't think it's a problem. I guess my younger self, you know, I went to Fresno State and I was writing poems there, and I wrote about 7 manuscripts before my first published book, and they were on a wide variety of subjects. So my younger self would get mad at me now if I whined about it, you know, because the idea that someone in a short life would sit down to pay attention to something that any one of us has done is an honor in the first place. And then to couch it in a certain frame to say, oh, this, you know, this makes me think of contemporary war lit or war writers of the past, for example, and talking about conflict and, you know, human suffering and those types of things. It's an honor right off the bat. But I think I do get to the point, what you're getting at. You know, it's just the landscape of the poems is war. So you can see the explosions, the accoutrements of war, the uniforms, the helicopters, and the different things you expect from a war or a conflict zone. But it's not actually the subject. The subject is love and loss. So I could turn my gaze and look at Baltimore or, you know, sort of war-ravaged America, where industry has driven people out of their jobs and their homes are in shambles and their lives are being crushed by the chase to survive, you know, and in a sense it might look, someone might say, frame it as labor poetry or something similar to that, but again, that would be the landscape. The subject would still be their actual lives and the people inside of history, and the subject would be love and loss. And that's my real through line, I think.
You wrote the poem titled The Hurt Locker before the film, years before the film of that name came out. And you've talked about this. People ask you about it all the time. I know whether there's a connection there. And in talking about it, I've seen you quoted saying that you're in some way a little uncomfortable about that because you don't think that's your best poem. Tell me about how that feels to have that particular work cited by so many people and your own feelings about that.
You know, I worked with Ron Charles at the Washington Post. He stepped down from there now, but this became a big question in some ways, at least for my life. And he was able to help sort of articulate the lineage of that story. So it's pretty long for this for your show today. So, but if people want, I've actually put a link on my website that sort of goes to the history of that, of how it is or it is not connected and all that kind of thing. I think for me, it's I guess part of me doesn't want to those who might say, "Oh, here's the poem that's meaningful from him, from me." You know, I don't want to undermine their appraisal of the work because it means they sat down to have an opinion of it. But I just don't think the poem, it doesn't do nearly as much of work as some of the others do, I think, and I think some of the others are more memorable in content and space, what they do. You know, a poem is the word stanza means room in Italian. And so poems are stanza by stanza, they're architecture, you know, so these architectural blueprints from an experience. And as a blueprint, I think that one does some work, it has some punch to it, but it doesn't have many layers underneath it. It does have some mystery maybe to return to, but I think a good poem or any kind of art, a sculpture, a movie, when you step out of the movie theater, a beautiful film draws you back in to see it again, and when you watch it again, then you pull some more meaning from it. And a poem has to do the same kind of work for me.
And one could almost say the same about music, could they not? Do you go back and listen to this record, transitioning back to the new work with your Interplanetary Acoustic Team? Do you get different things out of it, hearing it a different time?
I do, especially because I suppose for me, it changes with moods and spaces. So, for example, I've been driving around the country the past month, basically, and in different states I've put it on and listened to the album at different times of day or night. And I think my part for me is because, you know, Elisa's voice is there, and so I'm listening to her. And so when the album is on, for me, she's in the room, she's in the car, she's on the journey, and she's alive. And so it's I could probably play it every day, and no problem. You know, but I'm trying to step outside of myself and think of how others might approach it. And I hope that they might find other layers. It's a very layered album, and each song has, if you listen carefully, you'll hear other elements. It isn't like a three-piece jazz, you know, band or like a blues band where you can just very quickly, you can suss out what the drums are doing. You can hear the bass, the guitar, the singer. This one has quite a bit of layers of things that are softer and off in the background that maybe people will hear on subsequent listenings.
So where do you go from here? Is this an entree into more music professionally down the road, or is it more of a one-off?
No, I hope so, mostly because I don't want to stop listening to her, you know, and I think there's so much that, you know, she had cancer, and from 2013 to 2016, she fought it. If you were with her in the last year or so of her life, she would have said to you that she felt that she was just coming into her own as an artist. And so I've made a promise that that I intend to keep, and that's to make sure that her work continues to develop and be shared. And so I'm trying to find ways for new work of hers to appear. And it's really tricky because I don't have access to her agency and the choices made. So at every step and every choice I make, I could be making massive mistakes that she wouldn't have made. So I have to try to think as much as possible, like, how would she approach the art whenever I'm working with her manuscript, like her book of poems? Her next book comes out in May of 2019. And then there's another album of music I'm working on, too.
Again, we're talking with poet and musician Brian Turner, a Valley native. His new musical project with the band The Interplanetary Acoustic Team is called 1111 Me Smiling. It's a collaboration with his late wife, poet Elise Kuznets, and it is available wherever you get your music, Amazon, Spotify. There's also a physical copy on vinyl that is due out soon, and you can find more at interplanetaryacousticteam.com. Brian Turner, also an award-winning poet, known best perhaps for his collection of poems, Here Bullet, work inspired by his experiences during the Iraq War. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's an honor, Joe. Thank you. Hope to see you soon.
Likewise.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, you can send us your comments via email at kvpr.org. And find our addresses there, and also subscribe to our podcast on the website, and download our mobile app for your smartphone and your tablet, again, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Monica Velez, Carrie Klein, and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. You've been listening to Valley Public Radio and Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.